Good morning. In 1988, Michael Martugo authored a book which is entitled The War Horse. It was not widely read, but Steven Spielberg decided to make a movie of it. And it was through the movie that its notoriety really did spread across the country. It is the story of a horse that was the pet of a little boy in England. And whenever the First World War broke out and Britain decided to enter into that conflict, they began to conscript horses for their various units. This horse was conscripted and taken off, much to the chagrin of the little boy, but he was comforted by the promise of the officer who would ride the horse. And the promise was that he would care for the horse carefully and return it at the end of the war to the little boy. And so the war horse rode off in glory with all of the wonder of the military beauty, and that was short-lived. The young officer was killed off of the back of the horse. The horse was captured by the enemy. The horse was forced to draw the cannons of war. He faced tremendous abuse, lost his ability to run, and ended up as a tragic figure between the warring components of the First World War. Coming off of that experience, the war horse made its way home and was reunited with his owner. That is one of the few positive stories that comes out of the First World War. For as you may remember, it was one of the most vicious, violent wars in all of history. It lasted over 4.5 years. 9 million combatants lost their lives, 7 million civilians. And it was out of that era that phrases such as trench warfare, hand-to-hand combat, and of course, chemical warfare were born. And as the war ended and the League of Nations was born, there was an attempt to put a positive spin on this tragedy. And the positive spin went like this. This was the war fought to end all wars. Clearly, as we look in the rearview mirror of history, we know that that was something of a premature judgment. For the war that was fought to end all wars was followed by the Great War, the Second World War, and then by the Korean conflict, and then, of course, by Vietnam, and then by the tragedies of the Middle East. And, of course, as we gather here this morning, war, the absence of peace, continues to haunt all of us. And so we are left with the question, I think, as people of faith, to explore the question around the wonderful anthem, "Glory to God in the highest, peace on earth." We are mandated to try to examine those words in light of the fact that the heavens, which reportedly first heard those words, are now visited regularly by missiles of destruction. And so we are left with the issue of Advent. What do we do with this strange word, peace, pax, pacem, in light of the realities of our history? Some say that we are left with no choice but to say there will never be peace. John Paul II, one of his last interviews, shared with the interviewer a dream that the Pope recurrently had. And as was his custom, it mixed a bit of humor with a rather profound insight. He said the dream went like this. He died, went to heaven. And he said to God, "God, will there ever be another Polish Pope?" To which God responded, "Not in my lifetime." A second question. Will there ever be women priests? Not in my lifetime. And then this question. Will there ever be peace in the Middle East? And in the dream, God wept. So some say peace is an elusive dream. Some say it is a myth. Some say it shall never be. And yet, precisely because of the conditions in which we live, could it be that ours is not a time to bemoan the absence of peace, but to rather raise up the dream of peace, the goal of peace, the possibility of living in a world absent of violence? C.S. Lewis once said that among his greatest fears was the notion that people of goodwill would surrender their dreams. And it seems to me that that is where people of faith in today's time find themselves. We can go ahead and bemoan the world in which we live, but have you noticed? It's the only world we have. We can bemoan our world, or then again, I believe we can make a decision. And that decision is whether or not we will surrender our dreams. And so we are left with the task of defining this third Advent light. Incidentally, it occurs in Hanukkah Light, written by Marvin Hamlisch, where he thinks and dreams of peace. And for that task this morning, I have turned to the Gospel of St. John, to the 14th chapter, and to the 25th verse, where Jesus says, I'm going away for a little while. And then he says, however, my peace I give to you. Marcus Barth, a contemporary theologian, has suggested in his book, Meeting Jesus Again for the First Time, that Jesus is unique in our history because Jesus is not only the living Word of God, but Jesus has redefined many of the words that we use to articulate the Word of God. And if that be the case, I am curious to apply that thought to the words of Jesus in this text. My peace I give to you. And I am forced by my Old Testament professor, John Patterson, to begin with the word that is used here, shalom. We use that everywhere in the church today. It's become part of our working vocabularies. However, I think many of us do not really grasp the fundamental meaning of that word. Shalom means a peace in which there is absence of conflict. Quite clearly, peace, shalom, has to do with living in an environment in which the conflicts of life are somehow silenced. And surely that was a component of the teaching of Jesus and his definition of the word. Think about it. The trips to Samaria and the raising up of the Good Samaritan in the story he told about mercy, they are not accidents. They represent the intentionality of the teaching of Jesus to somehow address the conflict that existed between Samaritans and Jews. It's no accident that Jesus healed the child of a centurion and was often found in dialogue with the Roman authorities of his time. Because, you see, I believe that Jesus was interested in trying to bridge the enormous gaps and chasms that existed between Rome and Jerusalem. I think it's no accident that Jesus was often found in the temple interacting with the Pharisees and the Sadducees of his time, the religious professionals. Because I think Jesus was somehow trying to address the issue of how the law gets translated into the spirit. Make no mistake about it, Marcus Bart is on to something. Jesus helps us to define the meaning of the word shalom in its fundamental sense. Come on. Let's try to make this work. I thought about that in relationship to a marvelous book that's been written by Michael Deaver. He was the chief of staff for Ronald Reagan. And he talks about the relationship between Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill. Two men who could not have been more different. One a political conservative, the other a political liberal. The one a man of Protestant tradition, the other a devout Roman Catholic. And during the presidency of Ronald Reagan, it was a standing custom that several times a week, the president and the speaker of the House sat down together and said, "How can we work this out?" And there's a beautiful moment in the book where Michael Deaver remembers a conversation between Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan. Tip O'Neill had been diagnosed with terminal colorectal cancer. And he said to the president, "I sure hope that all of those candles I lighted and all of those masses I've attended are going to get me into heaven." And Ronald Reagan thought for a moment and he said, "Mr. Speaker, should you die before I do, when I get up to heaven, if I discover you're not in there, I'm not going in either." Two men trying to resolve differences. And surely that is needed in our age. I think we need to desperately resurrect and hold high the dream of shalom, the absence of conflict. Clearly, we must address the conflict that this morning is raging in our culture between Muslims and those of other traditions. It's palpable. I mean, a mosque was firebombed. My little student, Rabia, tells me of what it's like to be a young Muslim student on a Benedictine campus, feeling this suspicion. Surely it is time to apply shalom to that arena. And what about the conflict and the brokenness between law enforcement and the community? I'm sorry. I think one of the most challenging and difficult positions to hold in our culture today is to be a good police officer. They are suspect. They are accused before they arrive. And they face unbelievable, momentous, instantaneous, life-altering decisions. Surely there is room for shalom in the relationships between our law enforcement and our communities at large. And surely it does mean exploring the possibilities between sovereign nations. How are we going to live in the 21st century in relationship to Cuba? How will we pursue our relationship with China and Russia? How will we deal with the emerging nations in Africa? Surely there is a place in the international setting for the reality of shalom. Ah. But let's return to Marcus Bart. Jesus redefined the words that we use to articulate the word. And Howard Key, the New Testament scholar associated with Princeton University, has said that the key to understanding this text is not only to grasp the meaning of the word shalom, but to grasp the meaning of the phrase, my peace. In a very scholarly kind of way, Howard Key suggests that this possessive notion of my peace shared with others defines the very nature of the gift. And he goes on to suggest that in the ancient world it was common, as people were greeted, mostly who were nobles and princes and priests, it was common for the greeting to go, shalom. However, as Jesus uses the words, my peace, Howard Key suggests that he is reflecting something that is unique to the gift that Jesus is giving. And my notion is that Howard Key, well, if you've ever read much by him, you know you have to listen to him. He makes a lot of sense. My notion is that Howard Key helps us to understand what Jesus is saying here. He is speaking of a peace that is within us. When Jesus offers my peace, he's talking about that sense of tranquility that can exist even when turmoil is all around us. He is speaking about an inner calm that is comfortable with itself when everything around it is threatening. The peace that Jesus offers us is what Paul Tillich once described in his Doctrine of Correlation as theonomy. That's just a big fancy word that means this. Paul Tillich said that at the ultimacy of faith, theonomy lives. And what is theonomy? It is the awareness of something that comes from beyond ourselves and yet has always existed within ourselves. It's not something that is superimposed upon us, but rather it is something that is encouraged to grow up from within ourselves. Jesus was a very interior kind of guy. It mattered to him what was on the inside. When we read in the New Testament that he looked into a person's heart with the eyes of faith, that has nothing to do with ophthalmology. That has to do with the reality and the sensitivity of Jesus to who we were and are in our most inner dimension. James Gustafson, the ethicist, once said that if you want to know who you are, you need to sit down by yourself in the dark and begin to sense all of the emotion, all of the energy that is resonant within your spirit. Jesus says when you do that, you experience the marvelous gift of his peace that allows for you to live with a sense of quietness and positiveness and awareness. And of course, to use an overworked word, servanthood. Carl Henry was a theologian of the last century. I think he is overlooked. But I think he raises some issues that are rather important. He challenged the church of his time, which was all caught up in Jesus and having a personal faith. He challenged the church of his time to remember that that personal faith always had social justice implications. And he went on to suggest that institutions, even the institution of the church, is really incapable of addressing the questions of an age unless it is comprised of individuals, as he said, who had the heart for those issues. I'm wondering if Jesus, in offering my peace, is not in some measure saying to us, you know, how can you bring peace to your church if your soul is angry? How can you bring peace to your world if your soul is inhabited by bigotry? How can you bring peace to relationships if you are at war with yourself? It seems to me that Carl Henry reinforces the urgency of realizing that shalom is ultimately enhanced whenever the peace that Christ offers lives within us. And somewhat secondary to that thought is this one. Jesus says, "The peace that I give you is different from the peace that the world offers you." Now, this may sound a bit bizarre, but last Friday, I found myself committing one of my most egregious sins in my life. I went to Macy's. My heart of hearts says, don't go there. But every now and then you have to, right? Anyway, I was walking through that maze of merchandise. And I guess because these words were running around in my head, I began to notice some things. I looked at so many of the options there, and I began to think how it was that many of them offer us peace. For example, I was in the electronic area, and I noticed this device that you can now relate to your smartphone. Incidentally, we don't have smartphones. We have dumb phones, because that's about it for us. Little texting here and there, and a hello. But you can now hook this up to your smartphone, so that if you're in Cleveland, Ohio, and somebody rings your doorbell in Peters Township, you can respond and say, "What do you want?" And I'm not available right now. I'm in the bathtub or whatever. And that did trigger, if you'll excuse me for just a moment, it triggered a wonderful bit of humor about a woman who was one day in the shower, and she heard this persistent ringing of the doorbell just constantly. And so finally she decided she had no choice, and dripping wet and without much on clothing on, she went to the door. And she said, "Who is it?" And he said, "I'm the blind man." And so she figured, he's here for a gift. I'll give him a couple bucks and I'll be on my way. And so she opened the door and he said, "Lady, on what windows do you want these blinds hung?" Yeah. So you have to be careful with your doorbell. Yeah. Anyway, I looked at that, and underneath the advertisement was, "This device will bring you peace of mind." Tuck that away for a second. Or then again, I got into the appliance section. And what I discovered there was that I could buy appliances that would give me the gift of leisure, that would in turn allow me to pursue meaningful, in-depth relationships, so that I no longer have to get up and make the coffee. Now I can preset the machine. And guess what? And therefore, Barbara and I can have more time to bond. I think we'll back off on that for a little while, but you get the point. Oh, and then, of course, here's the big one. There's the internet and all of the devices we can buy to be on the internet. Because isn't it true that the internet will help us communicate better? Really? I noticed something about shopping when I was out there. Just to show you how cool we are and how sophisticated we are. We now have a chip card. We have a little chip in our credit card. You know, stick it in. At Macy's, there are multiple stick-in experiences. Yeah. You stick it in and it figures out whether you get cash back, free money, a life insurance policy, or a free physical exam, you know. But they have to get the card in there to... But then the big sign comes on, remove the card, okay, right? Because now what we have to do is once we've determined what you're entitled to, then we have to get around, as the woman said, to the charging factor. So you have to stick your card back up in there again. And what I was impressed with was, number one, the laborious nature of this device that is supposed to speed you on your way. And then the second thing I noticed was I got about 3.5 feet of receipts. I thought the cash machine was having something of a stroke. It just kept... And then they fold it all up and they give it to you. And you ever wonder, what do you do with all that stuff when you get home? Yep. So... I'm a little dubious about the internet, but here's the real issue about the internet, I wonder. Yes, the internet is a marvelous gift, most times, to communicate information. What about feelings? Does the internet allow you to look into the eyes of someone? Does it allow you to truly hear their voice? Does it allow you to perceive their presence? And I think that in relationship to those three illustrations I've just raised, I have some responses that might make you think. We have a young man, Michael, who takes care of our computers. And he tells me every time he comes that he's going to put a new protective device on my computer so people can't get in there and do bad things. But then he says this, and you know, Jack, even as I'm installing this, there's somebody out there who's figuring out how to break it. Have you recently listened to the advertisements for Rosetta Stone language programs? Will a bigger TV make you a better person? Will more shoes enhance your life? And of course, when it comes down to the internet, you know, when I faced cancer several years ago, the greetings that I received over the internet were kind of meaningless. It was the visits, the calls, and it was that little package that arrived one afternoon with 6 muffins in it that some student had baked. That's what makes the difference. And I think that's what Jesus is suggesting to us. So much of the peace that is offered to us at Macy's or in any number of settings, it's very transitory. It's terribly superficial. And ironically, sometimes it actually exacerbates the tensions that we're trying to resolve. The wonder of the peace of Jesus speaks to us in ways that are lasting, significant, and that even a power outage cannot interrupt. I'm showing my age this morning by quoting Henry Sloane Coffin, great theological voice of the last century. Great story about Henry Sloane Coffin. He came to the Pittsburgh Seminary, your seminary out there in Highland Avenue. He came there as a guest preacher for a week, and pastors in the community were asked to host him. And I was given the privilege of taking him to lunch and then touring the East Liberty Presbyterian Church. And of course, as you know, when you get down into the basement of that church, there's the crypt where the melons are buried. And as we were moving through there, the docent, who was terribly, terribly serious about all this, got us down in there, and he kind of got hushed in his voice, and he said, "Now, we're going to the crypt." And Coffin said, being an old coffin, he said, "I'm always interested in crypts." Well, that went right over the guy's head, you know. So we get to the crypt, and of course the gates are locked. And Coffin says, "Who's in there?"
The melons.
"Oh, the melons. Oh, I see. Well," he said, "why are the gates locked?" "Oh," said the docent, "we only open them on Easter Sunday morning." To which Henry Coffin replied, "That's damn presumptuous." Yeah. So maybe you can see why he's one of my favorites. Yeah, he has a healthy irreverence about him. Anyway, Henry Sloane Coffin once wrote that the Church of Jesus Christ needs to be the voice of the counterculture. Now, that's not an adversarial relationship. So that's not a holier-than-thou relationship. That has nothing at all to do with blue laws and absurd social mores. That has to do with speaking to the human condition and whether or not the environments of that condition are helpful or disastrous. I think that for people of goodwill who dream the dream of peace, it's important to talk about the peace that lasts, that is substantive, what Tillich called that theonomy. The thing that's in there, where we are at harmony with ourselves, and thus at harmony with others. Oh boy. And then a footnote. Jesus closes this little verse. It's a rather cryptic little verse, really. He closes it with the words, "And let not your heart be troubled, and neither let it be afraid." The overarching implication of that notion is, guess what? There is no perfect world. You do know, of course, that the early church, based upon some of the statements that Jesus made about the kingdom, operated with the notion that the kingdom was coming. And everybody was going to have free health care, the whole nine yards. Well, obviously that didn't happen. But throughout our history, over and over again, we have attempted to resurrect that idea. And unfortunately, I think from time to time, we provide people with a very poor juvenile understanding of the world in which we are going to live. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, in his work, The Cost of Discipleship, talks about living in the world come of age. And in that discussion, Bonhoeffer suggests to people of faith that we had better take a look at the world come of age. And what he says about it are, I think, curious. He says, first of all, in the world come of age, we have to learn to treat people as adults. In the world come of age, God appears to be powerless and pushed aside. And he illustrates that by this season of the year. I mean, come on. The Prince of Peace, born in a stable, resting in a manger, attended by shepherds. Wouldn't you think a palace and a lovely cradle and surely some Presbyterian preachers? Third thing he talks about in the world come of age is that the world come of age is going to do some terrible things. Because it can. We now have the capacity to inflict enormous pain on each other, not only physically, but emotionally and mentally. The world in which we live is not perfect because it's come of age. Therefore, I think whenever we hear these words of Jesus, he is readying us for that. But in that environment, Jesus says, let not your heart be troubled. And let's think about that word for a little bit. That word means don't let your heart be upset. Don't let your heart become something that is filled with disgruntlement. Don't let your heart become something that is all caught up in negativity. Let not your heart be troubled. And when you think about negativity and when you think of being disgruntled, have you noticed something? Oftentimes in those settings, we are prepared to surrender what could be for the convenience of what is. And sometimes when we're upset and anxious and filled with a sense of despair, we're prepared to say, oh, what does it matter? Relevant to our values. Being disgruntled is more than being in a bad mood. Being disgruntled is the lens through which we view the world. And it would seem to me that Jesus is saying here, be careful with that. Don't become troubled, disgruntled, despairing, anxious. Because in that moment, you may very well surrender some things that are worth holding on to. And then this phrase, don't let your heart be afraid. Do you ever think about afraid? I'm sure we all have. It's the fear. Is defined by a fellow named Alvin Schwartz, who teaches psychiatry at Yale. He says that fear, being afraid, can be two things. It can be a very intelligent assessment of the moment. If you're not afraid from time to time, there's something wrong with you. You're either not seeing the picture or you're not too smart. He also says that the other option in the context of being afraid is to make very bad decisions. And I'm indebted to his work here to illustrate that. He says that oftentimes, shots, we're talking bullets, shots are fired in the night out of being afraid. He says oftentimes, the development of scapegoating is the direct result of being afraid of your losing your position. He says that being afraid or fear oftentimes immobilizes a person to the extent that they will do anything to be freed. And as I read history over and over again, I sense that there's something to that. Who among us this morning would not say that there are moments in time when we should be afraid? You know, 5 years ago when I was wheeled into an operating suite, everybody had a mask on. It was quiet, it was cold, everything was wrapped in plastic. I recognized absolutely nothing. And I'm sorry if I embarrass you, but I was afraid. Conversely, we must always guard against fear that causes us to make bad decisions, shots in the night, using those terms of derision because people are brown or black or yellow or gay. And sometimes giving up the thing that we treasure the most in order to be free. I think the most significant illustration of a life that understands that was born back in the 30s. He was born to a horse farmer and a woman who was known for her soup. And they lived high in the Himalaya Mountains in Tibet. After a series of interesting procedures, this little boy at the age of 3 was identified to be the next or 14th Dalai Lama. And so Gyutsu Tenzin was taken from his family and his home, taken to the capital, and enshrined in this huge, great, big palace to prepare him for his role. That preparation included everything being done for him, including the worship of him. He was given a class education. He was taught theology. He was carefully nurtured. And then at the age of 15, he was confronted by the invasion of his country, Tibet, by the Chinese. At first, the invasion promised they were there to take care of, that they wanted to enhance and enlarge, that they wanted to provide better agriculture, better water systems, and on the list went. But in reality, the invasion was what it was, an attempt to acquire real estate. The Dalai Lama, in relationship to some of his advisors, attempted to interact with China. In fact, he made a trip to China where he met Mao Zedong. And for a time, actually entertained a relationship. Upon his return to Tibet, as he moved through the streets, he saw the evidences of the Chinese occupation, the people who had been murdered, imprisoned, the buildings knocked down. And he made a choice. The Dalai Lama fled Tibet, and in 1959 became a refugee in the country of India. Now, given that background, don't you think that the Dalai Lama could have become a very violent, angry man? Don't you think he could have resurrected all of the strength that was at his disposal to attack the enemy? Don't you think that the Dalai Lama could have created a moment of scapegoating, firing in the night? But notice what he did. He built a Tibetan culture in exile that includes universities, that includes cultural centers, that includes hospitals, and yes, that includes an advocacy center that for lo these many years has heralded the cause of the Tibetan people under the domination of the Chinese government. And he's done that in a way that has won for him a Nobel Peace Prize, the respect of the nations. And I think most curiously, it has won for him a position in the international scene where the Chinese do not know what to do with him. It's true, he's still living in exile. But ironically, so are the Chinese who are trying to dominate that country. The Dalai Lama once wrote these words, and I'd like to close with them today. Peace will always elude us. Peace does not mean the absence of conflict. Conflict and differences will always be there. Peace means solving these differences. Solving these differences through an ultimate sense or means. That ultimate sense or means includes dialogue, stability, education, knowledge, and humane ways of not only treating others, but understanding ourselves. Jesus said, "My peace I give to you. I do not give you peace as the world gives you peace. Let not your heart be troubled, and neither let it be afraid." That's pretty much all I have. So maybe you have some interaction or questions. Got somebody out. I have a question. Yeah. Right. This is just my response to that. I think that when I or the text talks about let not your heart be troubled, neither let it be afraid, based upon an internal awareness of peace, that must be understood not as protection and insulation, but rather as energy. Leslie Weatherhead, a great voice of the 19th and early 20th century in England. Incidentally, lots of people get that mixed up. They call him Wesley Leatherhead. No, it's Leslie Weatherhead. Okay. He once wrote a book where he talked about the importance for Christians to have fire in their bones. My mentor, Carl Michelson, talked about being preachers that have about you the heat of battle. Now, those images and those figurative statements, I think, suggest what I mean by energy. So that I need the calm, I don't like that word. I would say the peace, the self-awareness, the self-assurance that is residing in our heart because of Christ. I don't think that means that we say, "Oh, praise God." I think that means praise God. But let's get out there and deal with the issues. And think about this. When you talk about someone dealing with issues, basically what you want is someone who has about them this sense of peace, this sense of calm, this sense of assurance. If you're in a room that's on fire, you do not want the person leading the group who is shouting, "Where do we go? What do we do? I'm sorry." You want somebody who can say, "Just a minute." That way, that grows up out of their sense of assuredness and reality. So you used a good word there, and I should have used it in my presentation. The word tension. You know, we want to get rid of tension. Of course, there's bad tension. I get that. I understand that. But I think we have to have tension in the world between the polarities, not because they should be adversarial, but because they provide balance. If you think about balance, that's what balance is. It's that moment of equilibrium between the polarities. If you're flying an airplane, you got three of them to worry about. You got pitch to worry about. You got yaw to worry about. You got roll to worry about. And if any of those get out of sync, at least the guys that I used to fly with, talk about you. That's when you get behind the airplane, and that's when you fly the Beechcraft into a hill somewhere down near Uniontown this past week. You got to stay in balance, and that balance implies tension. So that when we apply that, to peace, yeah, Jesus says, "My peace I give you." But I wish, isn't this awful? Please forgive me in advance. I wish Jesus would have hooked on a couple more sentences there that would have gone like this. My peace I give you so that you can get out into the world and make a difference. But he didn't. Yeah, the other place. You're right. Please. Oh, yeah.
Because if, let's say, you see this child who drowned on the shore.
On the beach, yeah.
You've got to be disturbed by that.
Yeah.
So inner peace, Jesus' kind of inner peace, has to be linked up with love. You're not going to be feel good until everybody has this peace.
Sure, absolutely.
That love has to extend this peace to the world. And you can't do that if you don't have it yourself.
That's exactly right. And you can't do it if you're operating out of a sense of fear, or if your own life is in turmoil. It just doesn't work that way. I see Ted back there.
Is it possible? I hear from that Jesus offers you a peace, but not a peace that you're going to experience in this world.
I think maybe he means this world. I think. That's just Jack. And I'll tell you why. I'm going to get... This probably means I'll never be asked back here again. when I look at Jesus, basically, yes, I see a lot of language there that reflects what is yet to come. But I also see a lot of language that says it's already here. I think Jesus was a guy who lived in the moment, who lived in the history of his time, and requires us to do the same, and gives us the gifts of faith that include, I would not minimize, that include whatever's out there, but equip us to live in the now. And I think that the peace that we're trying to define here this morning, and that's probably a good committee assignment, because I think everybody has a contribution to make to that. Okay, but the peace we're trying to define here is not a peace that we have to wait until we get to heaven or wherever to experience. I think it's something that is experienced now. And as you've indicated so well, it has all kinds of dimensions and requirements associated with it. And when we talk about out there, I can remember my dear old father who was facing open heart surgery. And he was 84 years old, and he was worried about it, naturally. And doctor told him, you have a 50% chance of dying on the table. You know, it wasn't a great moment. And his minister arrived. And he said to my father, John, if this surgery works for you, you'll be able to continue your life and your ministry here on earth with all your friends. However, and I'm thinking, uh-oh. He said, however, if it doesn't work and you die, you can get out there and meet all the people that are waiting for you. And we just sort of sat there in kind of an eloquent silence. And my father finally said to him, before you go, would you just say a little prayer? And he did. and left my father and me sitting in that very deep quietness that we often visited in our relationship. And finally, at one point, my dad said to me, "Hey, boy." "Yeah, Dad." He said, "Who in the hell do you think's out there waiting for me?" my point being that, yes, if you ask me, are we more than this 70? Of course, we got to be. And are there dimensions to us? James Taylor has that wonderful phrase where he talks about the moment in which these atoms are gathered up into yet a more perfect form. I also believe that that perfect form is here. It's kind of a Platonic notion. Yes, there's something out there that's perfect. But by glory in Jesus, I think we have the opportunity to at least experience it. Not in perfection, but the CNN Heroes thing that's been on the air and so forth and so on. I think that's a perfect illustration of what we're trying to talk about here. If you look at those people, they're pretty self-assured. They're pretty grounded. They're pretty okay within their own skin. And there they are, worrying about the kids in Nepal, or the people in America that don't have the money to buy the prostheses. That's the tension, I think, that we're really about. Anybody else want to offer appreciate your comments and your questions? Next week, the big one. We're going to talk about love. So everybody bring a Valentine, all right? Yeah. Thank you for coming today, and we'll see you.